So, good morning. So I was joking, I had to get my coffee. Actually, I was not mindful. I was thinking that the time the class was 10:30. I'd just taken my shower, I was drying off, and I looked at the chart and it said 10 to 12, not 10:30 to 12:30. So if I'm missing some garment of apparel, it's because I threw them on and ran down here. So excuse me. So let's begin with a little calming of the mind and a chance to try to develop a good motivation and a connection with the subject today, which is going to be on the four close placements of mindfulness, is one of the translations. So sit comfortably. Relax your body, which for some of us is already a difficult thing to do. Sometimes when your body is very tense, that can prevent you from entering into meditation. Eventually, the meditation can relax the body, but sometimes you can scan the body, tensing the muscles successively of the various parts of the body and loosening them, letting them loose again to relax the body. But the real art is relaxing the mind. So to do so, first of all, begin just with a handful of observations of the breathing, of the respiration, recognizing when you're breathing out, recognizing when you're breathing in, keeping your attention on the turning points, and letting go of all other thoughts. Let go of your attention to the body. If your eyes are completely closed, you may have more of a apprehension of your body. Just slightly open your eyes slightly, and then sometimes occasionally open them a greater degree so some light comes in. Let go, besides of the body, let go of your apprehension of a self who's observing this breathing. Of course, the consciousness is observing the breathing. But don't make yet another observer of that. Just the consciousness observing the breathing. Now follow one breath in as though it were going to the middle of your chest, to the heart chakra. Let go of your attention to the breathing. Of course, it will continue by itself. And just focus on the contents of your mind at first, your mental consciousness, not your eyes or ears, nose, tongue, or touch consciousnesses. Within the spaciousness of your mind, there may appear to be different objects of thought that you might ordinarily follow. Use your determination, a sense of determination, to say, I'm not going to follow any of these right now. Just let go, defocus on the thoughts, the objective thoughts. And instead, refocus your attention on the space between the thoughts, either temporally. You know, there might be some instance when a particular thought fades and another one rises. Or even when thoughts are present, recognizing that there has to be a certain quality of clarity or spaciousness where that thought is occurring within the mind. Again, as with the breathing, even when the onslaught of thoughts have calmed a bit, there may still be a sense of the body looming there, irrefutable, your own body. Recall that that is being apprehended by your mental consciousness, via your sense consciousness, your tactile consciousness. It's just an appearance to the mind, like these other thoughts. Try to analyze how the mind is apprehending that, the clarity of the mind to which that object is appearing. Wherever the body appears to your mind, there is the spaciousness of the mind and its quality of knowing. So turn your mind away from the objective thought to the subjective mind that's apprehending it. Even more subtle, there is a dualistic sense of a self that's observing the mind. Beyond just the mind observing itself. that too is an appearance to the mind, like a thought. So to apply the same antidotes to that, recognize it can only be occurring within a spacious, immaterial mind that doesn't hinder the arisal or dismissal of thoughts. The mind that is clear and knowing, and focus on that subjective mind that just the moment before was apprehending your sense of self. The space that may be appearing to your mind is its clear nature. It's in no way the higher concept of emptiness. But this is our, what can be called our developmental or conventional Buddha nature, this conventional clear light nature of the mind. An incredible resource that we have as a human being right now, this lifetime. Of course, we will have that nature in future lives, even if we were to be born as an animal or in hell or other realms. But as a human, we have a chance of actually observing it and recognizing it and being motivated to use it to its utmost potential, to develop the good qualities, beginning on the path to enlightenment, such as the topic of today, the four close placements of mindfulness. So think, I'm going to try to take advantage of this opportunity I have this lifetime. I don't know how long it's going to last. I could pass away during the class. I could die tomorrow, today. I'm going to use this opportunity today to participate in the class, the talk, listening, contemplating, meditating, contributing. As a way to accumulate virtuous energy, virtuous karma, merit, that will act as a support to develop renunciation, bodhicitta, the right view of emptiness. And of course, the material that I'm learning as the material cause of those realizations. I think I'm going to participate in order to achieve ultimate enlightenment of a Buddha for the sake of others, not simply so that I can be the first one to eliminate my problems, but out of an empathy, a concern, a compassion for others. So try to set a strong motivation at the beginning. We say at the three important times, the beginning, the actual time of any practice or meditation, and the end. The beginning, we want to have a very strong motivation that will shape the karmic consequences of the action. During the action, we want to keep our concentration and perform whatever action it is, whether it be prostrations or offerings or meditation. We want to do it in an undistracted and correct way. And at the end, we want to dedicate the merits. And then bring your attention back to the present. See you. I remember once visiting Sri Lanka. I was in between some activities in South India, and I had to leave the country in order to get my tourist visa. You know how that works, or used to work, at least in India. So I thought, I'm down in South India anyway. So I think I took a plane to Sri Lanka. It's just a short trip. And I stayed at a Theravada monastery around a big lake in the capital. Eventually I went to Kandy and saw the Buddha's relics. Has anyone ever seen the Buddha's tooth in Sri Lanka? Isn't the Buddha's tooth there? Some relics. And very amazing when they bring it out. Only once a year or once every couple of years. Does someone know? But when there's something, they open the curtains. It's behind some things. They open the curtains every couple of hours, and there are the monks playing kind of like the Tibetan flutes, you know, very like invoking, you know, to the presence of the Buddha, you know. Anyway, while I was there at the monastery I was staying, there was one monk who was the kind of the abbot of the monastery. And he's about my age, a little bit older. He was renowned to have some kind of special powers. He had taken on the task of taming one wild elephant that had killed some people. And just through his patience over many, many days and weeks, the elephant had calmed down and would eat out of his hand and things like that. So he had some kind of celebrity in Sri Lanka. So I asked him while we were having a meal. He'd sort of given me some special privilege to sit with him and talk. He spoke some English. I asked him what he would like to, you know, what the aim of his practice was. And he said he wanted to realize the 37 harmonies of enlightenment. Have you heard of the 37 harmonies of enlightenment? Many different ways that is translated. 37 wings, or anyway, 37. And 37 harmonies with enlightenment also. What did I call it, 37? So in this topic that we're talking about today and next week, next Saturday, the four close placements of mindfulness, this particular subject matter comes as the first section. There are seven sections in the 37 harmonies of enlightenment. And the first section, which are these four, so you count four, four of the 37 are these four close placements of mindfulness. So they're the close placement of mindfulness on the body, close placement of mindfulness on the feelings, or you could say sensations, the close placement of mindfulness on the consciousness, the mind, means primary consciousness, and the my fingers, I have to hold on, the four close placements of mindfulness, the close placement of mindfulness on phenomena, which are the subject, which are the particular objects of the mental consciousness. So do you know what the, anyone here can tell me what the other 37 harmonies of enlightenment are? There's seven sets. So the first one takes place, starts on what's called, and we'll go a little bit, we'll give some background on this, starts on the path of accumulation. It's the way of, one way at the very beginning of entering into the Four Noble Truths, understanding the Four Noble Truths, not tooths, Four Noble Truths. And the next one, you were going to say, was it? What's he saying? Oh, no, well, that's one of them. That's one of them. But usually the way that they're often enumerated is in terms of when they're first generated in their proper way along the five paths. So have you heard of the five paths? Okay. So who has not heard of the five paths? Okay, so give you an idea. Both on the Hinayana path, which nowadays mainly represented by the Theravada, between the demarcation of actually entering into the, let's call it the Theravada path, okay? The demarcation of entering into that is the development of a spontaneous renunciation, one which doesn't have to be, you don't have to use any effort or thinking or conceptual things. Oh, this is the nature of suffering. There have you have this natural sense of, a sense of disinterest, even repulsive apprehension of cyclic existence, all the wonders, and a desire to achieve liberation. When you have that particular point, that particular mind, we call spontaneous renunciation, not just what we try to generate now through meditation. That's just a similitude of that, facsimile of that. When you have that state of mind, you enter into the first of the five paths that lead to liberation on the Theravada path. It's called the path of accumulation, or you could call it the path of collection. There are different ways of translating it. I think Edward Kahn's, what did he try to say? He talked about something as though, from the Prajnaparamita Sutras, when you talk about a person who's going to set off to war, at first they have to accumulate, they have to collect or get all of the armor and weapons and everything. So it's like on that first stage you're accumulating the needed factors to progress further. So it's on that path, the path of accumulation, that you first begin to get involved in these four close placements of mindfulness. Then the next one is called the four, well, one way of translating, according to Jeffrey Hopkins' translations, the four thorough abandonings. And what that means, you know what those are? The four? abandoning afflictions that were already generated. Generating afflictions that are not yet generated. So in other words, giving up, not generating afflictions that are not, that is preventing things from arising. First, abandoning things that are there, preventing things, bad things, from arising. Then increasing the pure phenomena that are already generated, and generating new pure phenomena that are not yet generated. This starts in the, you know when this starts? In the middling path of the path of accumulation, this first path. So the four close placements of mindfulness are kind of like the main occupation of the Theravada practitioner. On the first part, once they've entered into the path, they already have spontaneous renunciation. It's their main occupation in the first half of that path. And then they spend time on these, what are called the four thorough abandonings. Then what's the next one? Do you know? Who knows? In the order of when they're generated. You know, they call the four legs of manifestation, which are aspiration, effort, thought, and analysis, or gross analysis and subtle analysis. They're called legs because they are prerequisites to magical manifestations. What do they call in the Theravada tradition? Do you know? Have anyone studied? I think they're called riddhis, aren't they? Like the word siddhi, but starting with R? Not absolutely certain. So these are attained on the great path of accumulation. Okay, so far we just talked about the first path of accumulation. So at a certain point on this path, let's say on the Theravada path, also on the Mahayana path, what's the demarcation for entering into the Mahayana path of accumulation, the first path when you're actually, you could say, I've entered into the Mahayana path, not just you've got your identity card for ABC or your Singapore identity card that says religion Buddhist. Does it say that on your, it does? Yeah. So from a Buddhist perspective, that doesn't make you a Buddhist. But you could become a Buddha. You can certainly become a Buddhist before entering into the path. Entering into the path has a very special significance here. From the Theravada point of view, it means the moment when you have this spontaneous renunciation. From a Mahayana point of view, what's the demarcation? I think I heard all of the words from different people. So spontaneous, effortless, bodhicitta, the sense of, you know, something akin to renunciation. It has an aim. It's not aiming for liberation like renunciation is. It's aiming for enlightenment. And it's not motivated by simply a revulsion for cyclic existence, but it's motivated by a compassion for sentient beings, knowing the suffering nature of cyclic existence, having been based on some renunciation. So also the Bodhisattva practices these four close placements on the first, you know, from the beginning of the path of accumulation, when they enter into the path of accumulation, when they have bodhicitta. And then from the middle of that path, they begin to practice, what do we call, the four thorough abandonings. And on the great part of the path of accumulation, they begin to practice the four legs of magical manifestation. Then the second path is called, variously, the path of preparation. Some people like to try, Alex Berzin likes to translate the path of, what is it called? Application. So path of preparation, path of application. You could say in there are various etymologies in the Indian treatises. One sense, it's preparing you to realize selflessness or emptiness on the path of seeing, which is the next path. So it's preparing you for that. Or it's applying these various methods that you are developing in order to get you to the stage where you can see selflessness or emptiness. So it's called the path of preparation. Do you know the demarcation? What is the point in which one enters into the path of preparation? Anyone know? Do you know? Say loud. Emptiness. Emptiness is always there. Understanding of emptiness. Yeah, okay. What do you think? Jeffrey, do you know? Path of preparation. It's so on the path of accumulation, you were both in the Theravada path and the Mahayana path, you're trying to understand selflessness. Mainly in the Theravada path, main emphasis is on the selflessness of the person. Mahayana path, we talk about the emptiness of all phenomena. And you are getting familiar with that. You may even have a realization of emptiness on the path of accumulation. Oh, realization? Possible? Sure, why not? We can have a realization of emptiness even before entering into the path. By realization, remember, those of you who are listening to the class that we were giving on, Thursday? I can't remember. Lodwick, Tuesdays and Thursdays. Realization, consciousnesses that realize their objects are of two kinds, generally. Those that are direct perceptions and those that are brought about through logic, pure stainless logic. They're called inferential cognizers. So it's possible to have an inferential cognition of emptiness even before entering into the path. You can realize it. But your mind is not strong. You don't see it completely. You don't necessarily have strong concentration, but you have a correct understanding of it. There are different kinds of bodhisattvas. Some realize emptiness before entering into the path. Did you know that? How many people knew that? Yeah, a couple. Okay, some of you heard. There is a fellow, I think his name is John Avedon, whose father was a famous photographer, used to take pictures of fashion models for Vanity Fair and all these magazines. And John Avedon, his son, was also a photographer for a while, but became an avid Buddhist. Is avid Buddhist, and there was a book that has come out with an interview with the Dalai Lama, John Avedon interviewing the Dalai Lama. It's a white book with a picture of the Dalai Lama on the front, on the cover. The picture is taken by John Avedon's father, Richard Avedon, the famous photographer. I think on the back it's sort of like the back of the Dalai Lama, I can't remember. In there, he asks a little bit cheekily, being a little bit cheeky, asking the Dalai Lama, what realizations do you have? You can imagine what I mean by being cheeky. Do you know what cheeky means? Is that a word you use here? Kind of a little bit naughty, or, you know, maybe you shouldn't be asking, you know. Like. And the Dalai Lama says, technically speaking, it's not proper for me to say, the Dalai Lama said, something like this. Not proper for me to talk about realizations. But between the two, Bodhi mind, bodhicitta, and shunya, means the is short for shunyata, the realization of emptiness. Between the two, which do you think he realized he had insight into first? You can guess. Into shunya. You would think, oh, bodhicitta must be easier to realize. We talked about this the other day in a couple of the classes. It's said that the practitioners of sharp intellect, who are also another name for them is those who are followers of reasoning. They're called followers of reasoning because they don't give total effort and allegiance to something until it makes sense to them. The other kind of practitioner who are those of less powerful intellect, they're also called followers of what? Yeah? Followers of faith, right? So maybe like many, well, the archetypal Catholic who goes to the church, or the archetypal Buddhist who goes with the joysticks to the temple and lights a candle, you know. They don't study anything, but they're practicing on the basis of faith. They don't need to be, it doesn't have to be proved to them. But the practitioners of reasoning, they have a little more in a deeper faculty of wisdom, and because of that, they're dubious. Maybe like a lot of us, you know, you have to prove it to them first. So that kind of person, once they have an insight into emptiness, that there is no self existing the way that it appears, wow, that energizes them, and they think, that means all of this time I've been working for this illusory self. There is a conventional self, but I've always been focused and grasping to a self that doesn't really exist, when I could have been identifying with the entirety of sentient beings. This is completely logical, like Shantideva says. You know, to identify, instead of identifying with this body and mind, to identify with the bodies and minds of all sentient beings and to alleviate their suffering, so that that individual then can develop bodhicitta more rapidly and become a bodhisattva. So they had an insight into emptiness, some kind of realization of emptiness that impels them to practice the method of equalizing and exchanging self and others, develop bodhicitta, enter into the Mahayana path of accumulation. So the second path is called the path of preparation, where the person has perhaps even not only an insight into emptiness, but has even can concentrate on it with single-pointed concentration. But they have not yet developed a union, as Jeffrey said, a union of shamatha and vipassana, or what's the terminology, calm abiding and special insight. Do you know what that means? Calm abiding is a state of mind where you have the ability to remain on an object almost indefinitely without being distracted by other things. You can abide on the object, and your mind is calmed of other distracting thoughts. That's what is called shamatha. And you have a very special kind of blissful experience as a result of having purified the winds, the prana, the chi upon which the consciousness rides. Within that state of mind, like a calm pond, so imagine a calm pond with a lot of calm pond or lake with a lot of little fish. What is a famous Chinese fish, or is it Japanese? The koi. Koi? Yeah, say right? So they're stationary in shamatha. That's there. Then in vipassana, you begin to learn. So they represent the ability to analyze. Generally, when you're practicing shamatha, when you develop shamatha, when you're concentrating on something, you don't do any analysis. You're just holding it single-pointedly. But that doesn't lead to the greater insight into emptiness. Just having understood emptiness first and then concentrating on it, you need to, within that concentration, then you need to reanalyze the concept of emptiness without disturbing the calmness of the pond of the mind. Like the koi fish beginning to swim, maybe at first they cause some little ripples on the surface, so they have to stop, let the pond calm, let the mind calm, and again learn how to analyze within that calm state of shamatha to develop this ability to analyze, which is a wisdom consciousness. It's actually a wisdom, aspect of wisdom, knowing, understanding. So the point when you have that union of calm abiding and the ability of the koi-like awareness, wisdom, to analyze without disturbing the surface of the mind, you know, the calmness of the mind, that's called the union of shamatha and vipassana. And when you have, when on the path of accumulation, the first path, you, it's just at the end of that, when you're meditating in that way and you develop that union and take as your object emptiness, that's the demarcation of achieving the path of preparation or the path of application, okay? Right? You correct me if I make some mistake here. That's the second of the path. The third path is called what? Do you know? No, you haven't heard. Power seeing? Path of seeing, okay. Do you have a Singapore accent or you have some other accent? I should struggle to understanding. Maybe because I've got the microphone. If you had the microphone, maybe I could understand better. So path of seeing. And what that means, the seeing is not through the eyes, the eyeballs. It's through, you could say, there's a text that I recite daily that says, transcending objects of other sight, ultimate truth is to be seen with the eyes of wisdom and gnosis, of prajna and jnana. Or in Pali, they say jhana, right? Oh, no, they just say jhana. They say jnana. So what it means is when on the path of preparation, because of practicing these 37 practices, such as the neck, besides the four legs of magical manifest, you start on the path of preparation, you develop what are called the five powers, a special power of faith, perseverance, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom, your prajna. Those are attained on the first two parts of the path of preparation, what are called heat and peak. And then you have, besides these five powers, you develop five forces, the same five things, but on a greater level that are obtained on the levels of patience and supreme mundane dharmas on the path of preparation. You know this, right? You know someone, you heard it at one time. So when you have practicing these five powers and five forces on the path of accumulation, understanding emptiness better and better. Up till now, you've had this union of shamatha and vipassana, understanding emptiness, but you've understood it via it's called a meaning generality, a mental image, kind of like the example I gave in the low grade class the other day of these little things that you used to look at, you put this little transparency in this little thing, and you'd see, the Eiffel Tower, or there's the Marina, what's it called, Marina Walk? Marina Bay? You know, oh, it's almost as though you're seeing it. In a sense, you're knowing that via this image, but your eye is not concentrating on the image. It's so as your eye is looking through the image, right, at the Eiffel Tower or the Marina Bay out there. Like that, at first you realize emptiness by means of a mental image. So you're not realizing it with bare perception, direct perception, naked perception. There's something like the veils, the even now I think in many Muslim countries women have to wear a certain kind of something covering their face, but at a certain period in some countries, maybe they weren't necessarily Muslim, but for similar kind of reasons, women would wear a veil over their face, either covering the whole face or sometimes in popular, sort of just covering from the eyes down or maybe covering the face. So you couldn't see the whole thing. A little bit like that, you know. You sort of get a sense there's emptiness there, and you're understanding it correctly, but you're knowing it by means of this mental image. The demarcation of transferring from the path of preparation to the path of seeing is when this veil, this mental image, becomes thinner and thinner because of your familiarity with this, and you eventually have a direct, bare perception of emptiness without any mental image at all. That's the onset of the path of seeing. So from that point, you become an Arya being, right? A superior being, because you are superior to ordinary beings who don't realize emptiness directly. Even the bodhisattva, the moments before in the path of preparation, are called ordinary beings. Ordinary because they do not realize emptiness directly. They do not realize the Four Noble Truths directly. So from that point, you start to practice you attain a special power of the seven branches of enlightenment. Do you know what those are? Seven? So far we had what? The four close placements of mindfulness, the four abandonings, four magical, or the eight magical, what was it? Four legs of magical manifestation. So was that 4, 8, 12, right? Then the five powers and the five forces. So that's 22, right? Then am I wrong? Did I leave out something? Doesn't sound right. Four establishes the mindfulness. Four through abandonings. Four legs of magical manifestation, 4, 8, 12. Five powers, five forces, says 22. The seven branches of enlightenment: mindfulness, discrimination of phenomena, joyous effort, perseverance, joy, pliancy, meditative stabilization, which means samadhi, and equanimity. So you have a special practice of these seven branches of enlightenment. So sometimes the whole set is called the 37 harmonies of enlightenment. These are called the seven branches of enlightenment. And then from attaining the path of seeing, also being an Arya, you practice what Jeffrey had mentioned first, the eightfold path: right view, right realization, right speech, right aims of actions, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. So 15, the seven branches of enlightenment and the Eightfold Path is 15 plus the 22. That makes 37 harmonies of enlightenment. So at the end of the path of seeing, you enter into the next path, the fourth path, called the path of familiarity or the path of meditation. I prefer meditation. It sounds easier. Go in Tibetan, Gomlam. What's the demarcation of going in from path of seeing to the path of meditation? Does anyone know? The first moment? First bhumi. Actually, when you enter into the path of seeing, you're on the first bhumi, right? So that's not the demarcation. The demarcation between the path of seeing and the path of meditation is that path of seeing actually, in a certain sense, is very short. We sometimes say 16 instants. You, in one meditative session, when you've realized emptiness directly, you eliminate a certain, you cease. You have a true cessation of a certain set of the afflictions that could be called intellectually formed ones. Not ones that are innate and inborn that continue from life to life, but somehow based on certain presuppositions of this lifetime that are very prevalent, but certain afflictions will never arise again in your mind stream. When you rise from that path of seeing, which is one meditative session, you are now in the path of meditation. And you're going to familiarize yourself or meditate again and again on emptiness. But through all of this, from the path of accumulation to the path of preparation to path of seeing, the path of meditation, I've mentioned the main object is on emptiness. But in a certain sense, using the common terminology of the Theravada and Mahayana and the real essence, you're meditating not just on emptiness of anything in general, you're meditating on the emptiness of the Four Noble Truths. In fact, you're meditating on the emptiness of the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. So we didn't talk about that the other day in the seminar when we talked about the Four Noble Truths. I mentioned there are 16 aspects of these Four Noble Truths. So at the end of the path of meditation, that's the fourth path, you enter into the so-called fifth path, which is often translated the path of no more learning, in Tibetan, mi lob lam, the path of lob means to train or learn. Mi lob means no learning. It means you don't have to learn anymore. You could say it's like graduation. No more classes. You've reached the goal. So the path of no more learning in the Theravada tradition, what is that state called? Do you know? Arhat. You become an arhat. When you become an arhat, you no longer have to, from the point of view of the goal of that path, of the Theravada path, there's nothing more to learn. You can just relax. On the path of, in the Mahayana path, the Bodhisattva path, after going through the path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, what's the demarcation? When do you achieve the path of no more learning in the Mahayana path? Cecilia, do you know? When you become enlightened, right? When you become Buddha. When all of the subtle obscurations. Oh, no, she declined. you make her feel worse by bringing her the microphone after she said she didn't know. Okay, so all of this starts from the on the path of accumulation, the Mahayana and the Hinayana, or let's say the Theravada and the Mahayana, the four close placements of mindfulness. So in one sense, the four close placements of mindfulness, at the very, very beginning, you enter into taking these up to mind in order to get a better understanding of the Four Noble Truths and the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. Later, you're going to use these four close placements of mindfulness in more sophisticated ways. But at the beginning, it's said that they're used in this classical sense. Once you've entered into the path to familiarize with the Four Noble Truths and especially the 16 aspects. Nowadays, in the Theravada tradition in Asia here, and also in America, in the New Age Buddhism, people often talk about the close placements of mindfulness in a much more relaxed way. Generally, you don't have to be on the path to practice the four close placements of mindfulness. You can use them now to get familiar with the Four Noble Truths. That's the purpose. That's the reason we try to do that right now. But technically, they're not the fully qualified for close placements until you enter into the path. Okay. So traditionally, you may be familiar with them, and you may not know that. For instance, the so-called breathing meditation that we did at the beginning, and that is done in many of the Theravada centers, either watching the breathing going in and out or concentrating on an area here right below the nose, feeling the breath, the warm breath as you breathe out, relative slightly cooler breath as you're breathing in. I suppose it's different when the temperature gets above, if you're in India or Burma or someplace, and the temperature of the air is hotter than your body. What's your body generally, body temperature? What is it? 97? Oh, 37.5. What is it in Fahrenheit? Is it 103 is a fever, right? Is it 97 or something like that? Pretty hot. So 35, body temperature is 35 point something? 37.5. If it was 37.5 outside, would you venture out? It's pretty hot, right? That's pretty hot. So if the temperature is hotter than that, when you're breathing in, maybe you're breathing in warmer air, and when you breathe out, you're breathing out cooler air on the lip here. But that's another way of watching the breathing. There are many, many different meditations on watching the breathing. That particular meditation is considered to fall within the close placement of mindfulness on the body. Preliminary. Also, walking meditation. I know Thich Nhat Hanh, people often do. Many traditions do walking meditation in between the meditative sessions when they're watching the breathing, let's say. They begin by watching the breathing, so they're doing the first of the close placements of mindfulness. Then in between session, they watch, they think, now the foot is moving, the heel is touching, the sole is touching, now I'm moving the other foot. They're concentrating on that. Being mindful of that. And in so doing, they're letting go of other thoughts. So the traditional way that people think of this is a way of relaxing. You know, if you go to Spirit Rock or something like that in California, in the United States, the people that believe they're practicing these close placements of mindfulness, practicing not with a basis of renunciation or bodhicitta, which is a real prerequisite to practicing, with the goal of achieving liberation or enlightenment, but just to relax, get rid of tension, so they can go back and make more money. You know, I don't think that's, you know, that's not bad. It's helpful to them, but it's not. It's a little bit misleading to people if they think this is the extent of the Buddhist experience. So successively, if you were to practice in the Theravada tradition, go to some meditation courses, then you would also do meditation on the feelings. You would watch the feelings within the body, analyze them in certain ways. You would watch, you'd have a close placement of mindfulness on the mental consciousness, the mind, watch that, that would come perhaps after some days or weeks, and then on phenomena, which would include the contents of the mind, the different thoughts and emotions that come up, particularly the meditating on the selflessness or recognizing the lack of a permanent self. Okay, so this is just giving you a little bit of orientation of where these four close placements of mindfulness come about. Do you know the name in the Theravada tradition? It's a very common name, what they call the, what close placement of mindfulness is said in Pali? Satipatthana, right? So in Sanskrit, do you know what Sanskrit is? So sati, I mentioned this the other day, sati is smriti, right? So I'd mentioned in one of the other classes the Sanskrit was kind of like the classic language that existed in India at the time of the Buddha, that was the Vedas were transmitted in Sanskrit and the Vedic scholars even spoke Sanskrit, but it was not the common language of the people. There were many vernacular languages that were called Prakrits, and one of them that the Buddha, that was renowned later at the time of King Ashoka, the particular way that they were transmitted is one particular vernacular called Pali. So in Pali, things like, I mentioned the other day, Dharma in Sanskrit, what is it in Pali? Dhamma, right? And Karma is Kama. I sometimes joke that Pali is a little bit like John Kennedy. Remember the American president, John Kennedy? Had this New England accent. A little bit like him talking about the Dharma. The Dharma. For some reason, the R's didn't come through in the New England accent. You know, Dharma. Yeah. So words are simplified, like smriti. In Sanskrit, you did not have, you could have combinations of two consonants right adjacent to one another, two different consonants. But in Pali, they were all, generally all simplified. Instead of D-H-A-R-M-A, Dharma, you changed the R to M. So it's Dhamma, Karma, Kama, and so forth. So smriti becomes, in Pali, becomes sati. And adhisthana, which means placing the mind firmly, becomes patana. I'm not sure why it's such a radical condensation. So this particular kind of thing is very popular in, you may run across it in Theravada courses or in, you know, meditation courses or in reading. There is a very famous sutta, so it's, again, not sutra. In Pali, the sutra is called sutta, is called the Satipatthana Sutra, right? And in that, there are statements that this is the one path. Also, there's another sutta called the Vipassana Sutra. And both of them make mention at various points that this is the one path. So sometimes people get the impression this is all you have to do, just satipatthana. This is the whole thing. All of Buddhist practice is this. Have you heard that? Something like that? From this little perspective we've given at the beginning, you can kind of see it's just a way the close placements of mindfulness are begun on the path of accumulation to familiarize yourself with the Four Noble Truths, and you continue them along the path, but they're not the only practice that one engages in. It's not the whole thing is encompassed in that. So today, as we're having a little bit of introduction into the subject, we'll go into sort of more detail last time. Let me ask if there are any questions so far before I go on. I've thrown a lot of things out at you. What if I were to ask you, what are the five paths? Would you be able to say? You should see if you can find either a list of them or see if you could recall. Path of accumulation, that's the demarcation of entering into the path, both the Hinayana and Mahayana. The path of preparation, the demarcation between the path of accumulation and path of preparation is when you have a union of calm abiding and special insight, realizing emptiness, not directly, but with a mental image. Then the path of seeing, when you become an Arya being, you perceive with your wisdom directly emptiness. That is a continuity of the path of preparation. When you have a union of calm abiding and special insight, realizing emptiness, and the mental image finally, after long, many, many, you know, lifetimes of meditation, that mental image disappears and you have a direct realization. This is a path of seeing. The next moment after the path of seeing is finished, you enter into this familiarization period, the path of meditation, or path of familiarization for a long period of time, accumulating merit, becoming more and more familiar with emptiness, and successively ceasing various delusions until you reach the path of no more learning in the Theravada path, when you become an arhat. Can you become an arhat on the Mahayana path before the path of no more learning? Anything, Jeffrey? Yeah. Can you? How? Yeah. So in the Mahayana path, there's even a name, a Mahayana arhat, 8th, 9th, and 10th bhumis. Even before you reach the path of no more learning, even before you reach enlightenment, you have a cessation of all of the delusions, all of the afflictions, so that they'll never arise again. And that you could be called a Mahayana arhat at that point. So anyone have some question? Yeah, Jeffrey. Yeah, pass that microphone.
Okay, Venerable?
Yes.
Okay, just in the beginning, you mentioned about the feelings, the mindfulness of feelings, and you add feelings and sensation together.
Yeah.
So because when I went to check with my few meditation teachers, according to a retreat, when you're doing meditation, experiencing, you are seeing that the feeling is feeling, sensation is sensation. It's not the same.
Mm.
But then, of course, when you're saying the same, can it be, if I in a meditation state, yeah, I feel that I'm, what is my feeling? If I feel, every time there's a new nature, pleasant, unpleasant, or it is neutral feelings.
Right.
So there's always a neutral feeling. So therefore, is it a sensation that you're talking about?
So from when we talk about this one, vedana in Sanskrit, I think it must be same in Pali, vedana. In Tibetan, we say sorwa. So it doesn't mean like having feelings for someone. Oh, I have feelings for you, you know, like emotions or something like that. It refers to the particular experience of which are of three varieties, that those that are obviously pleasant, those that are unpleasant, and those that are neutral. And there are two varieties of those. Those that arise within the senses, you can actually have pleasant feeling of eye consciousness. A little bit interesting if you try to understand this. It doesn't mean, say for instance, if you get some, you know, an insect comes in your eye, you might think, oh, your eye consciousness feels bad, you know, irritated. That's actually body sensation, right? If you see a pleasant, you see someone who's handsome or attractive, you might think, your eyes might bug out and say, whoa, nice, you know. Probably a lot of that is your mental, you've seen something which your mind finds, in thinking about it, finds attractive, and is probably a lot of it is mental consciousness, mental, what we call, when you talk about mental pleasant feeling, we call that also happiness. Can you think of something that's obviously a pleasant visual, a pleasant feeling within visual consciousness? Seeing some, say, for instance, maybe just seeing something, even with the bare, the primary consciousness, seeing the leaves in the background and just soft colors that are soothing to the eye consciousness, not something discordant and bright and discordant like that. Pleasant feelings of sound, again, doesn't mean, oh, you are so wonderful. Again, that's probably, those sounds are heard by the mental consciousness, observed by the mental consciousness, and maybe the ego feels pleased about those. Pleasant sounds would be what? Say, for instance, the opposite of pleasant sound is like the example of taking your fingernails on the blackboard. You know, this is or static or something like that that causes some unpleasant feeling within the ear consciousness. Nose consciousness now is getting more and more obvious. Visual and auditory feelings are a little tricky because you can mix them up with the mental apprehension of them. Can you have pleasant odors, pleasant feeling of nose consciousness? When you smell some nice fragrance, was it? Roses? Durian? What is it? Certain kind of incense? Oh, sandalwood incense. Sandalwood incense, sure. Something that's pleasant. That's more obvious. And of course, your mind may elaborate about that, but it seems to be that there is a feeling within the nose consciousness. In fact, you might want to, you know, clear your nose when you get some bad. If you smell, you go to the open the door. There was a commercial on TV I saw not long ago. Some fellow is. They're taughting this thing to clean your nasal, when you've got some nasal congestion, and he's walking around the house. He's walking around the house. He says, "I can breathe." And then he walks into this doorway, and then he goes, and then his wife is changing their baby's diaper, and so you have to be careful, you know. So tongue consciousness, tongue feeling, obviously there are some that are pleasant, and we crave those. But it is, seems to be something that's more obvious. Body sensations also very obvious, that which is pleasant and that which is unpleasant. Extreme heat, which is something which is apprehended by body consciousness, can make your body consciousness feel unpleasant, clammy, hot. A cool breeze when you're hot can cause the body consciousness to have a feeling of pleasant feeling. A soft caress or in sexual embrace, you know, those kinds of feelings, besides the mental apprehension of them, also are generally considered to be tactile feelings. So what was your teacher? You said one of your teachers said there's a difference between sensation and feeling. So what's the point?
Because feelings is definitely under three categories of new. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral.
Right.
But sensation is not, because sensation is separate. Sensation is only the body feels sensation, but you don't involve in mental feeling. Because you feel that there's a movement, you feel that your body, there's some itchy.
Okay,
here,
so this is just an interpretation of the word sensation. This is sort of an etymological argument that the way that this teacher is interpreting sensation is that you can have various sensations. But it is used. I don't like to use the word sensation, but some people don't like the word feeling, and they want to use, Buddhist scholars use the word sensation. So as Jeffrey says, you have to analyze, you have to be very careful with words. We may associate in our mind a certain meaning with a word, almost as though it's inherent in the word. Even the word sensation can be used in various ways, and the word feeling can be used in various ways. Say, for instance, Catholics, people who have been brought up in the Catholic Church. Anyone here raised Catholic? Or maybe you know someone who's Catholic. There's this, one of the rites that they are supposed to partake in is of confession. At least that's how it's translated nowadays. You go in this little booth to the priest, and you tell the priest. In the past, generally men. I don't know if nowadays if there are women priests in the Catholic Church. You told them your sins, and they supposedly they're not going to tell anyone else, so you have some feeling that you can let everything out and ask for forgiveness from God. So if you have that particular kind of idea of confession, and you might, as a Catholic, you might be completely fed up with that, you know. And then you hear about Buddhist confession, you might think it's the same thing. The word sounds the same. In fact, it may be good to use a different word, like the Tibetan word. The two words that generally are associated with confession in Buddhism. Do you know what they're in Tibetan Buddhism? Do you know Tibetan a little bit? Shakpa, usually like we say confession, shakpa. Shakpa actually means to open up. To, you know, so sort of like you have a log and you hit it with an axe and a rotting log, and it opens up and you see all these termites inside and everything. It's sort of like coming to grips, you know, with all of the negative things that you've done. Another one is tolwa in the various prayers. We say shakso mi tolwa, I will not, or tolo, I will reveal. I will explain. So to admit. So to admit that you've done certain things. So from a Buddhist perspective, the whole perspective of confession is much different than confessing to God and asking forgiveness. But the word is used the same. So you have to be very careful. So this is a very good point Jeffrey brought up about, you know, sensation and feeling. Anyone else have a observation or question? You have, yeah. I say sorry. Yeah. All right, good. We got a little line going here, yeah. Sort of relay.
Thank you, Venerable, for
Put it close to your mouth, yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Venerable, for
Yeah, I think it's on. You have to speak up.
For giving us the framework to place the four applications of mindfulness.
Can you hear her? Maybe it's not on. No, I guess it's not. Did you turn it off? Is it on? Is there a red light on the bottom there? Green. It should be on.
Okay. Well, could you just say a little bit more about the peak, the heat, and forbearance that, you know, is supposed to be
on the path of preparation.
The path of preparation.
So, yeah, maybe fine detail. So the first path called the path of accumulation. Second path is called the path of preparation. And it has four levels that are variously called heat, peak, forbearance, and highest mundane dharma, highest mundane practice, you could say. So what these mean a little bit, at the first part of the path of preparation, do you know why it's called heat? Why it's called heat? Do you know why the first part of the preparation is called heat? Warm. No, you already have bodhicitta because you, on the path of accumulation, to enter into the path of accumulation, you have bodhicitta. There's various degrees of bodhicitta that, I was at 23 kinds of bodhicitta all the way to enlightenment, but you already have bodhicitta. There's a certain warmth, a heat close to realization of emptiness. You start to have some not necessarily the body. It's almost like the wisdom that realizes emptiness now is often likened to fire. Wisdom is often likened to fire. In the same way that anger is likened to fire, but in a different way. What does anger do? Why is anger likened to fire? Do you know? Do you know? Have you heard? No? If you get angry, what does it do? It's said to burn up the roots of virtue, virtuous karma. Virtuous karmic seeds that we have accumulated, having accumulated virtue in the past, we left imprints in our mind stream. By getting angry, that state of mind is a very destructive, one of the most destructive of the emotions. That's why it's very important to learn about patience and the antidotes to anger. Because anger not only creates negative karma, very heavy negative karma, and can cause you to kill and harm and do various things that embarrass yourself, harm yourself, but it burns up the potency of virtuous karma seed, karmic seeds. Like if you take a tray of seeds that might otherwise grow as rice. Is it rice seeds do you have they plant? Or maybe even seedlings. In Thailand, other countries where they have all of these levels where they plant, what do they plant? They plant already the seedlings, don't they? Do you know what I'm talking about? So they're potent. And they're putting in the mud with the water. They're ready to give. If you were to put a whole tray of them in the oven at, you know, 250 degrees for, you know, an hour, they come out. Almost, they look a little bit different, but if you plant them, are they going to give the same, what do you think? Are they going to give the same growth of rice? Sometimes if you leave them in long enough, they won't grow at all. So that's kind of like the effect of anger on our virtuous karmic seeds. So that's why anger is sometimes likened to fire. Wisdom is also likened to fire. How? It can affect the negative seeds, the negative karmic seeds, and cause them to lose their efficacy. So as to extol, you know, to realize emptiness, the wisdom of emptiness, is like a fire that burns up our negative karma. So on the first part of the path of preparation, there's this little intimation of that fire of wisdom. The real fire of wisdom is going to come when you achieve the path of seeing, when you actually destroy the afflictions from the roots. Okay? Is that making sense to you? But you get an intimation of it on the first part of the path of preparation, because now you have a combination of special insight and calm abiding, focused on the meaning of emptiness, but by means of this mental image. But now there's something that gives you an intimation that this ability to destroy them is gone. In fact, they do lose. They become less manifest, much less powerful on the path of preparation of the delusions, even though they're not eliminated completely and they're not abandoned, they're still reduced. And then, what's the second one called? Peak. I can't remember why it's called peak. Maybe it comes back to me in a second. Forbearance, the third one. You know, when we talk, or patience, different kinds of patience, different divisions of patience. The impatience of voluntarily enduring suffering, you know, just maybe because of having become familiar with feelings and so forth, realizing this is the nature of samsara. That's one of the main kinds of patience, not getting irritated, right? The patience of not retaliating. Various kinds of patience. One of the kinds of patience is the patience of enduring the study of the Dharma. or forbearance, forbearance of dharmas. What that means is there's certain things that are, in two senses, that are difficult to keep on because they're unclear, like emptiness and so forth, unclear to our minds, so we give up. We don't have the patience to continue, but also forbearance in recognizing the nature of ultimate phenomena. Do you know the word forbearance? It's often translated as patience also. I'll see if I can find some more detail for you later. But the last one, the highest mundane dharma, the last part of the path of preparation, are the last moments before you enter into the path of seeing. Now, the path of seeing, the Arya path, you become an Arya being, superior being. The moment before, you're an ordinary being. You're a mundane being. You could say the mundane path ends at the end of the path of preparation. Mundane means worldly path. The supramundane or Arya path begins at the path of seeing. So the last part of the path of preparation is called the highest mundane dharma, the highest mundane practice, where you have the meditative equipoise on the emptiness of the Four Noble Truths and their 16 aspects, but by means of a mental image. The next moment after that path is finished, you enter into the path of seeing, and it is no longer a mundane path. So this is called the last part of the path of preparation is called the highest mundane practice, highest mundane dharma. Okay. Yeah, here we go. So I wanted to introduce, I'll leave a second at the end also for more questions, but I wanted to introduce a little bit more about what these four close placements of mindfulness are going to be investigating, are called the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. Remember, I mentioned this in one of the other classes, on the seminar on the Four Noble Truths. I remember in Taiwan many years ago, Lama Yeshe had sent me to attend some conference he was invited to, and at Fokan Shua, I don't know how it's pronounced, Fokan San. Okay, my bad pronunciation of Chinese. So we took the bus from Taipei down to the monastery. I can't remember the name of the city. Was it Kishong or something like that? Kaohsiung. I remember going on the bus, and there were some public relations Taiwanese on the bus telling us, oh, look at how good we Taiwanese are. We buy American Greyhound buses to balance our trade. Anyway, that's not important. And we get to Fokan San, and I was sort of curious about the monks and nuns. Very good monks and nuns, so well behaved and educated. So I was checking, you know, do you know the Four Noble Truths? Of course they know the Four Noble Truths. Do you know the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths? Of course, up and down, backwards and forwards. Okay. And I said, what's the definition of bodhicitta? And then there was this kind of like, it was interesting because I think something, they're very special insights in the Tibetan tradition that have been accumulated from Indian Buddhism. It doesn't seem that was this particular kind of understanding of the meaning of exactly what bodhicitta means was transmitted, at least in their curriculum. So they would say, oh, bodhicitta is like wonderful, like skies, loving and everything. Do you know the definition of bodhicitta? A definition of bodhicitta? In Haribhadra, in the Abhisamayalamkara, which was revelation by Maitreya, to Asanga, right? One of the five texts that Asanga taught, Maitreya taught Asanga in Tushita Heaven after his 12 years of retreat. In those 12 years of retreat, Asanga never had one good dream till the end, you know. And the only thing I could think about my 3-year retreat was that was any way comparable was that I never had one good dream either. I'm not saying that I'm like Asanga. It's probably, in my case, this is a deficit. But so in this text, there's a very famous line, Semke Pani Shendon Chir Yangdak Zogbe Jangshub De. Semke Pani means mind generation, which is the technical word for bodhicitta. Semke Pani Shendon Chir, for the benefit of others, Shendon Chir Yangdak Zogbe Jangchu de samyaksam bodhi, to wish for yangdak zukpe jangchu de, to desire to achieve the ultimate state of Buddhahood for the sake of others. That's what bodhicitta is. So it has two aspects. One, for the benefit of others, out of compassion for them, wanting to alleviate their suffering, feeling incapable now, no matter what we do, even on the path of accumulation, preparations, the only way is to achieve enlightenment. So to desire enlightenment for that reason, that's kind of like the meaning of bodhicitta. And there are many debates about that, whether bodhicitta is a primary mind or a mental factor, or is it desire? Is bodhicitta desire? So forth and so on. Aren't all desires bad? And there's many, many debates. So the reason I mentioned that is they knew the 16 aspects, so that's what I'm going to talk about next. So what are the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths? So each of the truths have four particular aspects that one meditates on, particularly to overcome certain misconceptions about those truths. Okay, so the first truth is called the truth of suffering or true sufferings. So the first aspect is impermanence. The true sufferings are impermanent. So to paraphrase Jeffrey Hopkins, the contaminated aggregates, the mind, the five aggregates, the mind and body, are impermanent because of of being produced occasionally, not existing forever. So this is something where you would use the close placement of mindfulness on the body to meditate on this. Second one is, the truth of suffering. Second aspect is suffering. Same word, dukkha, that the nature of all true sufferings is that they are of the nature of being unsatisfactory, of being dukkha. The contaminated aggregates are suffering or miserable because of being under the influence of outside, because of being under outside influence of contaminated actions and afflictions. So our aggregates, this is very important, our aggregates are, which we call true sufferings, are miserable, are unsatisfactory, are of the nature of suffering because they're under the influence of our contaminated karma and afflictions. You may remember in one of the other classes I mentioned, the present Gandantipa, the throne holder of the Ganden tradition, Lama Tsongkhapa's tradition, when he was visiting Deer Park, I told the story in the other class, and people had prepared this beautiful room with flowers, the fruit tray. Every time I think of this, I kind of chuckle. And they thought, they said, Rinpoche, how do you like? He was a visitor many times to Deer Park, our monastery, because he had been a disciple of Geshe Zopa, when he was a young boy, as he was growing up, you know. And he sort of looked and he said, it's all suffering, you know. You know. So to recognize that all of cyclic existence, you know, the things that you might like to achieve, like relationship with a particular person or a particular job or a particular position or joy or whatever, particular pleasures, freedom, power, wealth, they are all of the nature of suffering because they've come about because of contaminated karma that was created by contaminated afflictions. So they are inevitably not going to be able to satisfy you. The third aspect of true suffering is empty. Sometimes it's emptiness, but it has different meanings. There are various ways of interpreting it. This third aspect of the first truth, empty, and the fourth aspect, selfless, sometimes refer to the same thing. Sometimes they refer to being empty of a permanent, partless, and independent person, which is a gross selfless, who's sort of like the intellectually formed sense of self of persons. And the selfless means being empty of a self-supporting, substantially existent person in the Theravada tradition. And many different philosophical interpretations of those two. So they're the four aspects of the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. I use these four fingers. So impermanent, suffering, void, and selfless. Right? What were you saying? Yeah, you say selflessness, emptiness, selflessness, or they are selfless, or you could say that the contaminated aggregates are selfless because of not existing as an independent self, but being under the influence of many impermanent factors, so forth. Now, sometimes these sound a little bit like, remember we had a seminar on the four seals? What were the four seals that certify a teaching is the proclamation of the Buddha? All compounded phenomena are impermanent. All contaminated phenomena are suffering. Those sound like the first two of these, right? All phenomena are empty and selfless. That sounds like the last two. It is. And what's the fourth one? Nirvana is blissed out, right? Chilled out. You know, there's some positive bliss there, but it's, you know, so like all of the delusion, all the problems are gone. Sometimes it doesn't seem as attractive. It sounds almost like kind of like gray twilight, just like no flashing lights, just everything the same. It's a great bliss. Nirvana is bliss. So sometimes you might confuse these four aspects of the first noble truth of those. There's another a set of four that's very similar that are quite related to this that are called the four distorted views that the also impermanence, suffering, unclean, and void. So the unclean is it an antidote to understanding that the aggregates that we might find attractive, if you analyze them, that they actually they have a much different nature than what appears to your senses and to the first your first understanding of them intellectually. The aggregates, say the body, if you imagine taking off the skin of the body underneath, the very attractive person that you might be sitting next to and in a heightened sense of awareness on your first date or something like that, you know, that they're actually underneath, that they're If you took off the skin, you would not be attracted to them any longer. If the body begins to decay, or if it has not been washed for a day and a half, Islam Azuba likes to say there's kaka coming out from every, there's an eye kaka. You know, what do you call that? Some sort of stuff in the corner of your eyes. There's ear kaka. There's nose kaka. There's mouth kaka on your tongue, on your teeth, and underneath your armpits and in your joints and everything. There's sort of skin kaka, you know, all sorts of bad stuff. So to meditate on the repulsiveness of the body, to overcome the conception that things are a nature of being pure when you just look at them, that's very, very powerful. Sometimes that can be misconstrued. You know, people might think, oh, then you get really fed up with the world. You don't find any pleasure anywhere. And this is not just to get, not to make you feel, not to make you feel miserable. Sort of like a mean father or mother or teacher or someone that wants you to feel miserable about everything. But it particularly to overcome attachment. Attachment is a state of mind that perceives something which, because of your karma, is experienced as pleasant. And because of that, the mind begins to use what's called inappropriate attention. Did we mention that term in one of the other talks? Inappropriate attention? Sushin mayimba. Sushin means in the correct way. Sushin mayimba means incorrect, inappropriate attention means thinking, you know. So I've got my cup of coffee here. It's called bulletproof coffee. Wow, that's good. Mm. If I had more of this, I'd be really peak shape. My mind would be so sharp. Or looking at something and thinking, wow. Oh, he's in good shape. Mm. If I had his friendship, I would really be, you know, that would be real happiness. That's what's called inappropriate attention. Rather than thinking, this is the nature of suffering. It's come about because of contaminated karma and the afflictions that drove them. Within the mind, you know, all of the components of the body and all of the components of the mind might temporarily, one aspect of them might seem attractive, but over time that would become less attractive to me and all of the other faults would become apparent. Sort of like, phew, Jeffrey, you can go. I'm just joking. That would be called appropriate attention from a Buddhist point of view. So the wrong conception about things being clean is equivalent, is in this sequence of the four aspects of the First Noble Truth: impermanence, suffering, void, empty, and selfless. It corresponds to void, because void in this context means being void or empty of being partless. And in one sense, it's talking about the gross selflessness, the intellectually formed selflessness of persons. But if you think of, if something is not partless, it has parts. The relationship is, if you analyze the body, many, many parts. The thing that you think of is just some pristine, pure thing. Food, if you analyze the parts and how they will change over time, the food that you put in your mouth, the very first, you hold it in your mouth for a couple of seconds, and then you take it out and you say, oh, would you like this? No one says, even if it's only been in your mouth for a couple of seconds, they don't want it, especially if it's been there for, you know, 5 minutes. All of your gastric juices have gone on it and so forth. It's already understood. And when it gets into your body and the nutrition is taken out and it's excreted out of your various orifices, most sane people are not interested in that at all. We like to flush it down the toilet. We don't even like to look at it. That's the end of that food. So those are called, so there are these three categories of things that seem quite similar, and they're all kind of related. The four aspects of the First Noble Truth, impermanence, suffering, void and selfless, or empty and selfless. The four seals, all compounded phenomena are impermanent. All contaminated phenomena are the nature of suffering. All phenomena are empty and selfless. So it encompasses all four. And then nirvana is bliss. And then these four misconceptions, one of which is that the body and other samsaric phenomena are pure. There's nice things out there, you know. We fall into that, you know. You try to have your apartment clean and have nice, pure things around. That's considered to be, you know, what's it called? You know, cultured, proper. If you go into your boyfriend's man cave. Do you use that expression here? We say in America, your husband or your boyfriend's man cave, their room, where no one else goes. It's magazines all over the place, pizza boxes, and, you know, dirt. But that's the nature. It's the mind that compulsively wants to make things attractive, not necessarily as an offering to the Buddhas or to offering to other people's minds so that they feel content, but as a sense of that there is purity in the world and you're going to try to provide it. That's kind of, it's interesting demarcation between that and a negative state of mind. Okay, so the second noble truth is called what? The cause of suffering or the truth? Origins of suffering, right? True origins. So this has four aspects also. And again, we're just going a first swipe today. Next time we'll go in a little more detail about all of these things, and especially how you apply the four close placements of mindfulness, how they're related to these. So the first one, true origins are causes, because they are the And what are the true origins of suffering? Remember? Two things. Karma and klesha, right? The KK. I know Singaporeans like initials. I remember a long time ago when I came here, they always talked about the four or five C's. They don't talk so much any longer, right? Do you remember what those were? Cecilia, do you remember? What was it? Car, credit card, country club, and cash? Nowadays, I don't know what they talk about. So, so the karma and klesha are the true origins of suffering, and they are said to be causes because they are the roots of suffering. They are what bring about, causes are the fundamental things that are the origin of things. True origins of suffering are called origins because contaminated actions and attachment are origins because they again and again produce suffering in all of its forms. Meditation on these as origins counters the notion that suffering is caused by just one cause, such as permanent time, as is asserted by the one particular Indian school called the Dipakas. What are they called? They're called causes, origins, strong production. And the fourth aspect of the second noble truth is called condition. Contaminated actions and attachment are conditions to because attachment to cyclic existence asks as a condition, cooperative condition for suffering. True cessations are called, I won't go into detail here, cessations, pacification. Jeffrey's translation of this, auspicious highness. Third one, and definite emergence. And true paths, the four aspects, are that true paths are indeed paths, because the wisdom directly cognizing selflessness is a path that precedes to liberation. They're called suitability, because they're suitable to be antidotes to ignorance, true paths. They're called achievement, because the wisdom that realizes selflessness is an achiever, because it realizes the nature of the mind unmistakably. And true paths are called deliverance, because they unquestionably cause one to pass into a state of irreversible liberation, extinguishing sufferings and afflictions completely. So they deliver one into that state. I just wanted to get those out. 16 aspects. To see if next time I can have, if I can get with our assistants some slides up there so you can see these things, write them down. So just as a final pulling together, the four close placements of mindfulness are the first four of the 37 harmonies of enlightenment that one practices based on real renunciation or real bodhicitta, spontaneous, effortless bodhicitta. When one has entered into the path, on the path of accumulation, it's where you begin to practice familiarizing with the Four Noble Truths. Generally, the close placement of mindfulness on the body is a way of entering into the truth of suffering. We'll go into more detail next time. The close placement of mindfulness on the feelings is a way of introducing one to the origin of sufferings, the truth of the origin of suffering, true origins. Why is that? Feelings? Oh, because investigating the feelings, you see how they're impermanent, they change. But because of our attachment to them, our attachment to pleasant feelings, and even a kind of craving to be free of unpleasant feelings, that gives rise to our delusions. All of the feelings, pleasant feelings give rise to attachment, unpleasant feelings give rise to anger and repulsion, and neutral feelings give rise to sort of a state of ignorance. The close placement of mindfulness on the mind is a way of entering into the truth of cessation, because by observing the mind and watching its calm moments, you can begin to understand how the delusions can cease. Many, many details to that. And close placement of mindfulness on phenomena is a way of entering into the truth of the path, the true paths. So again, the couple minutes left, in that my fault, I came 5 minutes late. So I'm going to be presumptuous and go 4 or 5 minutes over. So any last questions? Anyone has something they want to clarify or correct or? Yeah. How does the practice of tummo? Okay, yeah. Good. Because we were talking about heat and fire and everything.
So
okay.
How does the practice of tummo aligns with that? That's part one. On the heat fire bit.
Yeah, interesting.
And part two is how does the six yogas of Naropa fit into the broader framework of the.
Oh. Yeah. You have to You have to be like a rock and roll singer. They always
sure. So
being right the close part, to their mouth.
The first part is a clarification.
Okay.
Which is how does the practice of tummo links to the inner fire and wisdom you spoke about.
Yeah.
The second bit is your views on how does the six yogas of Naropa actually link to the broader framework of we should discuss
of
six yogas of Naropa. So like
how does it relate to
the broader framework that you discussed in the morning?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So interesting. So generally, there's a kind of experience in the practice of esoteric Buddhism we call Vajrayana. You've heard of Vajrayana, right? Tantra, so forth. Where, and then you can, I think mainly you don't find so much in the Hindu tradition of tantras this a concentration on a certain location in the body, by concentrating there, the natural heat, a certain kind of heat can be generated within the it's a subtle body, and it can cause the gross consciousnesses and the pranas, the chi, the gross ones that we're experiencing now, to absorb in the same way that they absorb when you go to sleep. You know, the eye consciousness absorbs, the ear consciousness absorbs, and you're left in a very subtle state of mind. So that in Tibetan, that's called tummo, the wrathful one. What is that in Sanskrit? I can't remember what it's called in Sanskrit. There's a Sanskrit word for that. I can't remember. So that heat of tummo that is a physical heat, whereas the heat one that we're talking and well subtle physical heat, whereas the heat that we're talking about on the path of preparation, the first level heat and so forth, and the fire of anger that burns up virtuous karma, and the heat and fire of wisdom that burns up negative karma, they are not physical fire. They are not physical heat. They are likened to heat in that heat has the capacity to burn, right? And so in analogy to them burning up this wisdom, let's say, burns up the potency of negative karma, it is likened to fire, but it doesn't. There's no physical palpable heat necessarily in the body. Whereas in tummo, this physical practice, psychophysical practice, there is a physical component. If you don't do it correctly, your whole body can get warm. There's all these famous stories of these yogis to test their, it's not correct, but anyway, supposedly to test their tummo, they would go out to a lake at night and someone would break the ice on the lake and they would put their shawl in the icy cold water and they put it around them, and with their body heat, meditating on tummo, they would dry out their shawl. I think Alexandra David Neal, this famous lady around the turn of the 1900s, he told stories like this. Even now, some Kargyu monks, they have some kind of practices like that. But the great tummo meditators say that this is not a real sign of tummo. This is improper application of tummo. If you have real proper tummo, all of the heat is within the subtle body, and the outer body doesn't heat up so much. Milarepa supposedly, when he got cold in his cave, he just had this one cotton cloth, mila. He would do, you know, he would let some of that heat come out into his body too, so that he didn't freeze to death. But in general, that's not considered. That tummo is a physical heat, whereas the heat that we're talking about here is mental. So good question. Okay, so I've kept you long enough. Let's just dedicate our merits that we've created this morning, sort of the third element, at the beginning, motivation, in the middle, keeping concentration and performing whatever action you're doing properly. At the end, to dedicate the virtuous actions, virtuous karmic seeds, like the reins of a horse, you know, pulling the horse, not to just letting it go wherever it wants, not letting the karma ripen in whatever way it might, but dedicating it in such a way that it, you make a volition, a determination, a wish, a prayer, that it ripen in a particular way. And that does have some influence on the ripening. Whatever way the karmic seeds that we've created ripen in the future, of course, as virtuous seeds, they'll arise as some contaminated happiness within cyclic existence. But in whatever way they ripen, may they become the cause of my continued dharma practice, life by life, year by year, life by life, and may they become the cause of conditions and causes of my realizing the three fundamentals of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, the right view of emptiness, become the cause, the living force of my practice of the six perfections, the force of my meeting secret mantra, the Vajrayana teachings, tantra, quickly achieving enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. May these karmic seeds not be exhausted until that state is attained. So giving it all away, you know, not having any expectations that you're going to profit personally in some samsaric way from these karmic seeds in the future, being clever at some cocktail party or, you know, having other people praise you or whatever, but dedicating them strictly to the ultimate aim of achieving enlightenment for the welfare of sentient beings. Thanks for your concentration and your patience. Hopefully we'll see you next week. We can finish up and apply the four close placements of mindfulness to these. And if you have time tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the two sessions tomorrow on the Mahayana grounds and paths.